Wow. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, y'all. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Ebony. I haven't had a drink since Friday the 13th, November 2015. I have a sponsor who knows she's my sponsor. I sponsor other people in Alcoholics Anonymous by taking them through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, page by page, paragraph by paragraph, line by line, starting at the blank page. My home group is the Cornerstone Group in Norfolk, Virginia. We meet Saturday nights at 7 p.m. We are a big book study. You're lucky if we get through a whole paragraph that night. So if you're ever down in the Tidewater area and you're looking for a meeting, please join us. I have a service position in my home group, a service position outside of my home group. This sounds like an AA resume. It's not, I promise you. I say all of those things because I'm shocked of who Alcoholics Anonymous has turned me into. The last thing I ever wanted to be was a servant. The last thing I ever wanted to be was a part of this thing that made no sense to me when I showed up. So I hear my old timer telling me how it works, tells me I'm supposed to talk about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now, not it. It being alcoholism has always been the same cunning, baffling, powerful disease. The only thing that's changed is me. And it hasn't been anything that I've done. It's been all a direct result of the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'll start by, you know, what I was like. I am the oldest of three. My parents are Billy Ray and Ethel May. I am a Leo. I am academically gifted. I am a former Division I scholarship athlete. I say all of that because these are all excuses I use on why I was not an alcoholic. Mainly because it's my, oh, and I'm also an educator. So I get paid to tell people what to do. And so I can't be an alcoholic. I'm not a director. I don't manage other people's lives. I don't know what anyone's talking about. Growing up, I wasn't raised in an alcoholic home. I've never wanted for anything. I'm actually incredibly spoiled. I am loved tremendously. I've had never-ending support. And I can say that honestly because I've taken inventory. But before I took inventory, I would have told you that I used to lie and say I was raised in a single-family home because my dad was in the military. And so he would be serving his country. And I would be at home jaded and upset, full of resentment that my dad wasn't there. So I would tell the kids, like, my mom's a single mom, because it gave me street cred in the suburbs. So, you know, I would have told you they didn't love me enough. I was misunderstood, that they didn't see how special and talented and amazing I was. They didn't nurture the talent deep inside of me. Growing up, I wasn't one of those children that got in trouble. I am a rule follower, type A, planners, Excel spreadsheets. I love a good spreadsheet. Color-coded highlighters. Never wanted to step out of line because I was full of fear. I was always afraid I'm going to do something wrong. Everything about me is already wrong, so I have to be perfect. I have to prove that I belong. I have to prove that I'm better than. I have to prove that I deserve to be here. You know, I was a practicing alcoholic without a single drop of alcohol. I have suffered from a spiritual malady since I came out of the womb, is what I think. You know, my mom always says I was a colicky baby, that I was always crying. They didn't understand why I was never happy. And I realized it was just because I needed a drink. That's all it was. I just needed a drink. You know, so growing up, I never saw my parents drink, really. Once in a while, we would do a wedding or go out, and I'd see my mom have a sip of a cocktail and say, like, ooh, I don't like this. It's making me feel boozy. And me thinking, like, it can't be that bad. Like, no. I see the other moms. I was raised in a military town. If you don't know much about Virginia Beach or Norfolk, of that area, raised in a military town, so the garage is a big deal. Everyone has TVs and setups in the garage, and the women are drinking wine coolers and the dads are drinking beer. And I thought my parents were boring because they drink sweet tea. And so I would watch them and say, I'm going to grow up and be just like them, the other parents. One day I'm going to drink just like that. And my mom used to warn us, and I didn't understand that she was warning us about alcoholism. But she would say, like, you guys don't drink because it runs in the family. I didn't know what it was, but I knew who had it. Like Uncle Bobby had it. Uncle Jimmy had it. And I was just like, here I am 6, 7 years old thinking, no, not me. I can't have it because I'm not country. Because I just assumed it ran in the country, but I was in the suburbs. So it's not gonna happen to me. One day I'm gonna grow up and you're gonna see me with the fancy cocktail glasses. Fast forward, not getting in trouble. I graduate from high school and I get a ticket to go live in DC and play soccer. And I'm so excited. And I'm finally happy that I'm breaking out of Virginia Beach because that city just doesn't feel right. There's something about it that doesn't feel right. So maybe if I go in DC, though, it's the place where I'm supposed to be. And so I meet my teammates and we're sitting there and I still haven't had it. I'm a late bloomer when it comes to drinking. So I haven't had a drink of alcohol yet, but it's freshman initiation night. We're at a house party. And for freshman initiation, they have to get the freshman drunk. And I'm freaking out inside thinking, oh no, I never drink. I'm 17. If I drink, it's against the law. I'm gonna, like, as soon as I touch the glass, the SWAT team's gonna come in. They're gonna point at me and say, you're breaking the law, and I'm gonna be locked up for the rest of my life because that's how my brain works. Whatever is the worst possible outcome is what's gonna happen to Ebony, which is why I have to walk this very tight line and hold myself to this high standard of life. And I'm always on edge and inside, I'm always uncomfortable, and I have to do it right. And if I just step out of line, everything in my life is gonna fall to shambles. And I still haven't had a drink of alcohol. So that night, they're all passing out double shots, and I convinced them, I bartered them down to a single shot of vodka, the only single shot I've ever taken in my life, I'm sure of. Unless it was like a quick, like in the bathroom, we gotta hurry up and take it before my friends find out. Like, yeah. So it's a single shot, and I can't tell you if I drink alcoholically that night. I can't tell you if I passed out. I can't tell you I woke up the next morning, but what I can tell you is how I felt. I immediately knew from that very first shot, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. I didn't know that I loved the effect produced by alcohol. I didn't know that my body reacted differently to alcohol, but I knew that I loved the way I felt that night. It finally felt like the world made sense, and I didn't have to walk that straight line. It wasn't as narrow as I thought it was. I felt okay in my skin. It was a spiritual experience, some would say. Finally, everything was right, and I decided I'm just going to do this for the rest of my life. What's wrong with this? So I go through school, I'm drinking, and I don't know anything about the progression of alcoholism. I think everyone piles of alcohol and hides it in their dorm room. Everyone takes the cash meals money that you're supposed to buy your food with. And they go and they find an upperclassman to go to the liquor store for them, and they just get some chicken nuggets instead. Everyone does this. I know when I'm going to parties that everyone has another bottle in their room that they keep for themselves, and then they drink the alcohol at the party but sneak back to their dorm room to just quickly chug and then go back like everything's normal. Like, I think that's normal. I don't know. So I graduate and I get my big girl job for the first time, and I'm in the career and I can legally drink now. And finally, I've made it. I'm living in DC and it's just like the movies, Sex in the City. And I'm here and it's girlfriends and I'm going to cocktail hours and I'm doing happy hour and I'm drinking my wine and I've got the nice apartment and I've got the right boyfriend, I've got the right job, and everything is good until it wasn't. One of my favorite lines in the Big Book is gradually things got worse. And I align with Bill. I remember when I first started reading the Big Book thinking, like, I was not the person, by the way, that started at the blank page of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was the person that had no money, was unemployable, didn't have anything to my name, so I had to check my first Big Book out from the library because I was too full of pride to ask for the free book that the meetings were offering. And so there's a chapter called There's a Solution, and I quickly went to that chapter to find the answer so that I didn't have to hang out with you all, and I couldn't find it, and it was like, you guys are misleading me. I say all of that because now I'm someone who's obsessed with the big book. Like every page I find me in it. And I remember Bill's story that them telling me, have I ever dreamt like that? Does that feel like something? Have I ever felt that way? Does that sound like something I would do? Because I definitely was like, there's no, I have nothing in common with this man from the 30s. No, not gonna find myself. And here's Ebony's story in Bill's story. And gradually things get worse for me. I'm working and I'm doing things like I would start drinking on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and eventually it went through the week and I'm still in DC. My teammates are still in DC and people are talking to me about my drinking and they don't know what they're talking about. They're just jealous because I can outdrink them and they have all these issues with my drinking, but it's not really an issue to me. I just got to figure out how to do it the right way. And then maybe these people will get off my back. And then like I'm starting to realize there's some things going on when I drink. I can't remember where I park my car. I can't slow down anymore. I can't, when I say I'm not going to drink, I accidentally drink anyways. This is kind of odd, so it's time for me to stop. And I remember that I had this friend who was Catholic and they did this thing called Lent. And so I decided, like, okay, I'm going to do Lent. I don't know what it's about, but I know I'm supposed to give up something good. So I'm going to give up drinking for 30 days and 30 nights. Don't even know if that's real, but in my head, that's what I decide Lent is. And I'm going to stop drinking. And I make this big proclamation. And of course, back then, even now, you've got to tell the world on social media what you're doing. So I'm like making a big deal. I'm done drinking for 30 days, 30 nights. Like, God is good. And I'm drunk like the next week. But it's not my fault. It's not my fault. I had to drink because you can't watch. Back then, it was like Grey's Anatomy, How to Get Away with Murder, and Scandal Thursday nights. And you have to drink that. You have to drink when you watch Shondaland. So it's not my fault. And then so I decided I'm taking it too seriously. I can drink on the weekends. Weekends include Thursday. And then weekends, the story, the weekend gets longer. And then the next thing I know, once again, I'm drinking every day. I'm showing up to school and now I'm starting to shake. And I'm pretty sure it's tied to the alcohol. But when my students ask me, I tell them it's because my blood sugar. And I'm working in this amazing school in the heart of DC with children that I love. I'm so passionate about what I do. And here I am lying to these kids. Now it's a Title I school. They don't have much at home. And these kids are stopping at the corner store to bring me candy in the morning because they know that Miss Ebony is shaking. And I'm just sitting here like feeling horrible inside, but also like, thanks for the candy, kid. Like, whatever, and so now I'm learning how to manage my alcoholism. I don't know what's alcoholism, but I learned that I don't know what's going to happen when I put alcohol in my system. So the best way to deal with this is before I leave the building, I have to make sure all my copies are made. Everything I need for my stations is set up. That my room, if I'm doing groups, I've reset my room. Everything is set up. So all I have to do is show up the next day because I don't know if I'm going to wake up in someone else's house. I don't know if I'm going to sleep in my car. I don't like, I have a go bag because I never know if I'm going to need an extra outfit. I don't know if I'm going home. So these are the ways I'm starting and trying to figure out how to still drink the way I want to, but also not ruin my life. But the thing is, things keep getting worse and I don't know what's happening. My school decides that they're gonna reformat and they're getting rid of the middle school because they want to do pre-K through third grade because there's no state testing and I have to get a new job and I get to this new school and my alcoholism is at its peak now and I've lost all my friends. I've cycled through the men and I'm just like, I've got to stop this. New school, no one here knows me. It's going to be a brand new start. I can do this. So I get to that school and They give me an amazing contract and signing bonus and like all this flashy, glittery stuff. But I'm living this double life and I feel like I don't deserve it because I know I'm going home and I'm passing out every night. I know that I'm walking to my car on break and I'm quickly chugging whatever I have at the time. I know I just cannot let these people find out who I really am. And I'm just now being pulled in so too many different directions. And I'm confused with why I can't find peace. I'm living a lie, and then at the same time, my truth is just unlivable. And I don't know how to get out of this. And so one day what happens is they call me down during state testing. If you remember a few decades, wow, that sounds old. A few decades ago, there was a big deal about all of this state testing and teacher scandals, cheating scandals. People were getting federal time with this stuff. And so it's state testing, and they call me to the office, and I'm just like, okay, because getting called to the principal's office, even when you're a teacher, is not a good thing, especially when you don't know why. So I show up in the office and I open the door, and it's the principal, the assistant principal, the head of HR, and my co-teacher, and they're all sitting there. And I'm just like, okay, what's happening? And they sit me down and they tell me someone had reported that I smelled like alcohol and they were concerned that way. And in my head, I immediately, do the drunk shuffle in my brain, trying to remember, am I drunk? Did I drink? Is there alcohol in my purse? Do I have something on me in my pocket? Do I have alcohol in my desk? And I'm just cycling through all this because I don't want to get in trouble. I don't want to lose my job. And they're just telling me to sit down. And my brain is going a million miles an hour trying to figure it out because that's my favorite thing to do. And I can't figure out what's going on with me. And if only someone understood, maybe I wouldn't have to live this way. And they tell me about alcoholism. And they sit me down and they tell me, like, hey, if you have a problem, it's okay. Alcoholism is a disease. And it's as if they had read a chapter in a book to people who hire people like me who suffer from alcoholism that told them step by step what to do with their employee. And they followed it. And they told me alcoholism is a disease. And if you want to go to treatment, we can send you, and no one will have to know. We'll hold your position, we'll protect you. It's not your fault. And they were so loving and kind through all of it. And now looking back, it makes me so grateful for the service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. It makes me grateful for committees like the cooperation with the professional community, CPC, or with the PI, Public Information Committee, getting the information out that there is a place for people like me to go. You might not suffer from alcoholism, but if someone you work with or someone you know, just getting the word out that there is something there for people like me. Because maybe they didn't read the big book, but maybe they had a PI card. Maybe they accidentally went to an HR fair and there was someone at a table with the AA people talking about alcoholism, annoying them to death, like, hey, we're here in case you need us. But whatever it was, they knew that there was a place for me and a seed was planted. Seed didn't bloom because I just looked at those people like, you're crazy. I'm not drunk. What are you talking about? I went to bed last night. I had this rule that was I wasn't drinking. I wasn't drunk that morning because if I went to bed at 4 a.m. and then I woke up at 6 a.m., that wasn't drinking on the same day because I went to bed. And so I walked out of that school because how dare you? Don't you know who I am? Don't you know what I've done for you? Don't you know my resume and my test scores? I'll just go to another school. And I'm so happy that those people pulled me aside and that I had it was probably the best thing for me. That ultimatum of either go to treatment or lose your job. And when I first showed up to AA, I was always like, I never got fired because of my drinking. I quit before people could fire me. And so I left that job and it gave me the opportunity to burn my life down. And I needed every single thing that happened in that path of destruction, that tornado of ebony, stealing, lying, manipulating, getting cars repossessed, getting evicted, cycling through men, just all of it. And at one point, I remember my younger sister, being so concerned. She was living with me at the time, and the girl she was dating's mom was sober and somehow gave my sister the miniature big book for me to read. All these little God shots of AA in my life, and instead of reading and opening that book, I used to sip my drink on it like a coaster because I thought it was ironic. Like, look at my alcohol on that AA book, right? Never opened it. But I think about that apartment because I that was another reason and another way in which someone was trying to give me the message that I didn't have to live that way. But I wasn't ready to hear it. I can't hear anything until I'm ready to hear something. And I'm never ready to hear something until God gives me the opportunity to be desperate enough to actually open my ears and still enough to actually want to take action. And so what happens is for the last time, I'm living with my boyfriend secretly. He doesn't know I'm living with him. He doesn't know I'm homeless. I got evicted while we were dating, but I had a key to his place and he worked somewhere else. And so I'm living there and he comes in town because he worked in New York but lived in DC. And he catches me there and he's had enough and he drives me down to Virginia Beach, the last place I ever wanted to be, back in the stupid city that no one understands me. Now I don't have a job. I don't have a boyfriend. All I have is this trash bag full of clothes, and I barely have anything in my bank account. And I have to look at my mom and dad. I don't know how I got here. And they just opened my parents opened their home to me, and they support and they love me. And I'm living there, and I decide like this has got to stop. So I'm gonna do what I know I'm supposed to do. I join church. I've been baptized three times. And I'm throwing myself into teaching Sunday school and doing Young Sisters in Christ, and I'm doing all this stuff, and I'm still doing it drunk, and I'm trying to figure out what's happening. And I wake up in the morning, and I can't brush my teeth without vomiting, so I have to drape so I can not shake and walk down the steps, and it's just this chaos. And my mom, the most amazing woman who I know, is looking at me and she's saying to my face, if you really wanted to stop, you would. And my dad saying, you can do anything you put your mind to. And me thinking, all of that is true, but you don't understand. Something's wrong with me. But I was done trying to explain that to people. So I was, they would just say this to me and I would just look at them. I don't know what alcoholism is. I don't know anything about this disease. I just know that something in me is broken. I feel insane and I don't know why I keep drinking, why I want to stop and nothing's happening. And so I do what I do. I reach out to a man on Instagram. No, this was Facebook. I reach out to this man on Facebook. It was an ex-boyfriend and I send him a message in his DMs and I tell him the truth. And I tell him the truth for the first time. Something's wrong. I can't stop drinking and I don't know what to do. And this man is stationed in Japan. And in my head, I'm going to tell him he's going to save me. Like either he's going to send me money or he's going to send me a plane ticket and I can go to Japan. And that's what I was hoping would happen. And instead, what happened is he gives me a phone number and tells me to call this phone number. And so I'm like, okay, whatever. So I call this phone number. It was a 24-hour hotline for Tidewater Intergroup. If you are not familiar with Tidewater Intergroup's hotline, we have a 24-hour phone number. Whenever you call it, another member of Alcoholics Anonymous always answers that phone. And it makes me grateful once again for the service structure, because that goes from home group to home group. Different home groups take turns answering the phone, doing phone watch. And today, on the other side of it, I know there's a whole process. You're supposed to answer the phone, get their name, find out what zip code they're in. And if it's a woman, I find a woman in that zip code. And I'm just like the switchboard, hooking an alcoholic up with someone who's extending their hand. I did not give the person who answered the phone for me that night that opportunity. I held him hostage. And this man talked to me about alcoholism. And he started to say some things that made sense to me. He started explaining exactly how I felt, which was kind of weird. You know, he knew that when I start drinking, it's something that says go inside of me, and I don't know when to stop. He understood that. He understood how I try to put things in order and I manage the pieces of the puzzle of Ebony's life so that I can drink, but something's always off and I'm unhappy and I can't control how I'm feeling. And he understands all that stuff. And I'm like, oh, he gets it. And then he brings up prayer and meditation, and I'm done because I don't want to hear about this God stuff. I told you, I've been baptized 3 times. I was doing vacation Bible school drunk. I was doing all of that church stuff. Don't you dare bring up God, the God that doesn't work for me. So I hang up on that man. I still wish I knew who it was. I promise I've probably come in contact with whoever it was, but I don't know who answered the phone that day. And so he did say one thing that was helpful. He told me about this detox center. So I called this detox center and I put my name, I put myself on the waiting list. And I decided I'm just going to keep drinking. Fast forward, Ebony gets drunk. What else is new? She disappoints people. What else is new? Something bad happens. What else is new? But this time, my dad is pissed. My dad, who never ever says no to me, has said no. And he puts me in the car and he drives me to that same detox center I put myself on the waiting list for. And I go into this place, they're full. And the lady tells me about alcoholism again, once again. And she tells me that detoxing from alcohol is dangerous and withdrawing from alcohol could kill you. And she starts naming these symptoms. And I'm like, oh my God, that's why I've been having seizures. I thought it was my Kindle. I really thought my Kindle was giving me seizures because I love word searches. And I remember, I was having seizures and this word search puzzle, and I go upstairs, I'm excited. It does not make sense why I'm excited about a seizure. And I go to my sister, and I tell my sister, "Watch this." And I'm staring at this candle, trying to make this seizure happen. Turns out I was withdrawing from alcohol. Didn't know it. Didn't know how dangerous it was. Do not recommend. 0 out of 10. Don't recommend. And so this lady tells me there's no room. And I say, I know I've already been putting on myself on the wait list. And she doesn't believe me because apparently alcoholics are liars. And so she checks the waiting list and she's shocked that this time I'm telling the truth. You should have believed me. And she says, well, if you really want help, we can take you to the psych center if you are going to be harming yourself or harm to others. And I say, absolutely not. I'm just going to go home and drink. This woman just told me all about alcoholism, and I'm just like, I'm gonna drink, girl. It's all right. Get over yourself. And she was one of the first resentments I put down on my fourth step, by the way. Because she looked at me and she said, I can tell you're depressed. I can tell you hate yourself. You don't look like you're enjoying life. Okay, all of that stuff was true, but how dare you say it? I've been working really hard to prove to the world that I'm okay and important. How do you see past this veil? And she says, well, if you're not going to check yourself in, then here, and she hands out this meeting guide and she points to this meeting and says, there's a meeting tomorrow at 7 p.m. You should go. And then my dad tells me in the car that if I don't go to that meeting, I can't live in the house. And I decide, I guess I'm going to go to this meeting. The meeting is at 40th and Pacific down at the oceanfront. It's at this church called Galilee. I don't want to go there because I went to Galilee all the time with my best friend. It was my best friend's home church. And so I don't want to go to this church because everyone there is going to know me and they're going to look at me and they're going to be disappointed because I let the city of Virginia Beach down. Like in my head, I'm going to walk in and they're going to be like, boo, tomato, tomato, tomato. We hate you, Ebony, you drunk. And so I hype myself up to go to this meeting. I walk into this meeting and I walk in and I'm pretty sure I'm in the wrong place because everyone there is laughing and smiling. And I'm there for an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I'm looking around and no one looks like me. And it's not because I'm a black woman. It's because they all look like they have jobs, and it looks like they're not stealing from their dad, and that they're not walking to Walmart with change to buy steel reserves to hide in the neighborhood bushes so that when they go on walks, they can chug them and get drunk. I must be in the wrong place. I'm looking for like the busted and disgusted crew. Not these people, not these happy boys and free disgusting people. And they're just like shake my hand and say, "Yeah, are you new? Yeah, this is AA. Come have a seat." And of course, I go and I sit in the back in the corner, my head down, and I cry the whole time. And it's just like the first drink, how I don't remember anything about it, but I remember how it felt. I don't remember anything about that first meeting either. Like that was the first meeting I kind of went to because I was looking for help. I had gone to one meeting before. I was blacked out. My mom made me go. She drove me. She introduced me to people. I don't remember anything about that. Besides the fact that my sister reminded me of that, like I was 5 years sober and she reminded me. So I'm in this meeting and I'm crying. I'm sure they talked about sponsorship. I'm sure they talked about a spiritual experience. I'm sure they talked about taking the 12 steps, being of service. Because now when I go to that meeting, I hear those things. But I didn't hear anything that night. I just felt like I was in the right place. And I just sat in the back and I just cried. And the meeting ends and they do this thing where they give out chips and they get to this white chip and the woman says, "This is the closest thing we have to a membership card. If you are sick of how you're feeling and you want to try this way of life, this chip is for you." And I think, absolutely not. And so she cycles through the other chips. And as she's going through the other chips, I think, wait a second. Maybe if I get a white chip, I can tell my dad I joined AA and he'll buy me a car. Because it's a membership chip. So when she came back around, because they do it again at the end of going through the chips, and I get up and I get that white chip. By the grace of God and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's the only white chip I've ever gotten. Nothing. I got my first white chip because I wanted my dad to buy me a car. And I kind of wanted to stop drinking for a small amount of time. And I'm grateful that it's with a desire to stop drinking and not an honest desire anymore. Because I didn't know what honest was. I couldn't tell you I had an honest desire, but I did have an inkling of a desire to stop drinking when I got that white chip. And so as the meeting ends, they did what the women of AA do. And I'm pretty sure the women of AA do that here because the way y'all welcomed me, I know it happens here too. I would get up and I'm trying to leave, and all these women swarm me with love. Like, "Oh, we're so glad you're here, Ebony. Here's my phone number." They've given me a guide. They circled all these meetings telling me to go here. "We're going to love you till you love yourself. You never have to drink again. You don't have to do anything alone if you don't want to. Like, this is the greatest day of your life." And I'm just like, disgusting. Get away from me. Don't hug me. Don't touch me. Don't love me. I know who I really am. You don't know who I am. How dare you say you're going to love me until I love myself? That's unimaginable. The thought of me loving me, you don't know who I am. So I leave this meeting, and the walk from the church is the longest walk. It is so long to get out of that church to the parking lot. And I'm trying to book it, and this girl comes up to me and she looks at me and she says, "Hi, I'm so and so. Nice to meet you. Congratulations on your white chip." And I'm sorry, she's online. And for the first, she says, like, "How are you?" And for the second time, I tell her the truth. Well, not to her, but for the second time, I tell the truth. And I tell her, "I'm 31 years old. I think I'm an alcoholic. I don't have a job. I live with my parents. My eggs are going bad. No one's gonna want to marry me. How am I supposed to live?" And she's gonna like, "How are you?" And she looks at me and she's like, "Oh, I just got out of rehab for the 18th time." I'm making up that number, but that's what I heard in my head. And I just got out of rehab for the 18th time. Found out I'm getting divorced on social media. Lost custody of my kids. Living with my parents. And I'm just looking at her. She's smiling while she's saying all of this. And I'm confused. Like, your life is garbage. And you're smiling. And I want to know, how do I get that? Because my life is garbage. But I want to smile the way you're smiling. And I ask her, how long have you been sober? And she says she's been sober for 12 days. And it was a newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous who changed my life. Because at that second, I wanted to be sober for 12 days. First, I got a white chip to get a car. But then I met a woman who gave me hope that maybe I could have what she had with 12 days of not drinking. You know, that woman introduced me to the woman who became my first sponsor. That woman introduced me to the group that became my first home group. She introduced me to a group of newcomer friends. My first sponsor used to call them my playmates. She told me I needed to get new playgrounds and playmates. And so she introduced, and it was a group of newcomers, and we used to just swarm meetings together. Be like nine of us with our big books and just showing up and all this stuff and sitting there. And we would do big book studies. If you've ever been to the BBRC, there's like this living, it's a house, so there's like living room spaces and couches. And we would be doing big book studies, never worked a step in my life. But we're be like, my sponsor can beat your sponsor up. Well, my sponsor's got 30 years. Well, my sponsor's got 27 years. Like, yeah. And we're just sitting here like, my sponsor's better than yours. You know, like, I can live off of my sponsor's sobriety. I can become happy, joyous, and free because she took the steps. But that's what, in my head, that's how it works, right? And so I have the sponsor in name only, unlike the sponsor I have today. I have the sponsor in name only, and I decide it's towards the end of the year now, and I decide that I've been separated from alcohol long enough. I can drink safely again. I come up with this plan because I'm convinced that I am an alcoholic because I'm going to these studies, and I'm convinced, yes, I drank like that. And I tell this woman that I'm going to drink again. I'm still on the detox list, and she says, let me know how that works out for you. You will get me drunk before I will ever get you sober. One of those old time riddles that I didn't get. And I'm just like, what? I don't get it. And I'm just like, how dare you? Don't you know I'm a real alcoholic? Don't you know how dangerous it is for me to drink? How do I know if I'll ever make it back? And then it clicked. That's why my other old timer told me we have steps for that. He used to always say that to me. We have steps for that. We have steps for that. And I, like, it was always just like over my head. And finally, I started getting to action. I became sponsorable. You know, I was the girl that would be sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I could make all the coffee in the world, and I knew everyone's name, and I could tell you the page and all of this stuff. And I wanted to die stone cold sober. I was suffering from untreated alcoholism in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, not taking action, not understanding why the people around me are getting better. You know, and that woman started taking me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous using the 12 steps and 12 traditions. I love the 12 steps and 12 traditions. It gave me relief. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for freedom, you know, and so I'm going through the 12 and 12, and I go to this big book study on Monday nights, and everyone there has this, like, they know the book, and I feel left out, and so I decide it's February, there are 28 days, I'm going to read the first 164 pages of the big book. I make a spreadsheet. It's about 7.5 pages a day. I'm going to know this big book better than the people in this big book study because I feel left out because God takes away the things that stand in the way of his, of my usefulness. And apparently my pride and my arrogance were useful to him because that's how I went through the book. And I would start reading the big book and I would show up to this other big book study in Norfolk where there's this man who at the time people made fun of him because they called him a big book thumper. And I didn't know what that meant. But every time I would see this man, I would ask him about what I read in the big book. And he would break it down for me. And we would talk. And then I would go home and I'd be doing step work with my sponsor through the 12 and 12. I'd be reading the big book through my spreadsheet. I'm stalking this man at this big book study. He's taking me through the big book. He realizes what's going on. He's okay with it. And he's just like, I'm happy you're seeking. Another old time riddle. Like, what? I'm what are you talking about? He's like, I'm happy you're seeking. Any way I can help you, I will. You know, and so then he tells me I can start coming. So now I'm going to this meeting an hour early instead of 15 minutes early. And I'm having this study with this man of the book, and I'm doing the 12 and 12 steps with my sponsor. And it's like they're saying the same thing, but one has much more depth and weight for me. You know, and I'm taking these steps and I get to the inventory part, you know, and I am a firm believer that today I'm just as powerless over alcoholism and over alcohol as I was the first day I showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous. The only difference today is that I'm connected to a power that stands between me and that first drink. I know that today, like, I have no choice. I have no say, that there's nothing I can do. I have no control when it comes to alcohol. I am absolutely insane. You know, and I love at the very end of More About Alcoholism when you read it, and it's like, yeah, now that you know all these things, guess what? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what you think you know about alcoholism, Ebony, because at some point in your life, you're going to have this blank spot. You're going to forget, and you're going to reach for that drink. And the only thing that's going to stop me is a power greater than myself. And all of a sudden, that same God idea that the man on that 12-step hotline tried to present to me that I was disgusted by seems like a great opportunity. Seems like the only choice I have. Maybe that God idea will work. You know, and so I move into the second step and I come to believe that maybe this thing will work. Maybe I get hopeful and I go through the third step and I'm like, okay, I'm ready. I did it. Pray. Let's go check. And my sponsor says, write inventory. And she took me through a worksheet. Fantastic opportunity to do some stuff. I love all the things, is what I'll say. My first time taking inventory, I did not take it out of the clear-cut directions from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's okay. I got some results from doing that. But before I started doing that inventory, I would just be going to meetings and I'd be proud to tell them, I'm on my inventory. I'm on the fourth step. And then you'd ask me 3 months later, I'm still on the fourth step. I'm on the fourth step. You know, and my sponsor is sitting here and she's like, how's it going? I'm like, it's great. She's like, have you started writing? It's right here. It's right here in my head. The worst place it could be. You know, because the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind. And here I am, I've got all of it right here in my mind. And I'm getting haunted by this stuff. I'm stuck in this cycle of resentment and fear. And finally, I go to this step study, and I walk in, and I think it's a men's meeting because there are no women. And so I'm about to walk out, and they're like, come in, Ebony. I'm just like, why do you know my name? It's fine. And I sit down, and they're reading the fifth step. So they're in into action, and they're talking about how if I don't do a proper house cleaning, I am destined to drink. And I get scared, a healthy fear that I don't want to go back to that life I was living. And so I'm walking out, and this man, I won't call him an old timer, this man's there, and he looks at me and he says, so what step are you on? I'm like, I've been on my inventory for, and he's like, how long? I'm like, I don't know. He's like, that means it's been too long. And he tells me, my sponsor says, I'm like, I don't care about your sponsor. It's with Bill Wilson. I don't care. Like, oh, leave me alone. And he tells me, well, my sponsor says that if I have a problem with a step, that means I didn't do the step before it properly. Oh, I did the third step. Or did I? What I did was I said some words that I didn't mean to check it off so I could hurry up and cycle through this so I could get my certificate and go. what I hadn't truly done, because I had hope. I had this hope that this could work for me, but I didn't have the faith that God could step in and use me and rebuild my life. You know, I didn't have that component of trust. I was missing that. You know, so I go back and I'm doing this third step and I am terrified. And my sponsor says, just pray and see what happens. And so I pray and I see what happens. And what happens is my hand starts to move against my will and I'm writing stuff and I'm cycling. I'm just going and I'm checking and it's just fantastic. And I get to do this fifth step with her. And I'm scared because I'm like, the things that I swore I would never say. You know, I don't want her to know about this stuff. And I'm sitting upstairs in the sunroom of the BBRC to do my fifth step. And I'm telling her some of the worst things on my inventory, the things that I swore people would just judge me for and hate me out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. She was certainly going to break up with me. And she looks at me and she's just smiling and she's just like, okay, what's next? And I'm like, what? Like, she's not impressed. It's not even doing anything. And she's also saying like, oh yeah, I've done that. Oh yeah, me too. And I realize I'm not alone. You know, and I take that hour afterwards of my fifth step. And I just sit and make sure, have I done everything correctly, you know? And then I go into six and seven. I'm going to fast forward to where I am in sobriety today, because I also want to talk about how much the Big Book and my experience has changed over the years. My current sponsor is a Big Book thumper. And whew, she's intense. And I need intensity. I am intense. You know, and my first experience of going through the steps, six and seven to me were just like, reading this thing, okay, whatever. I've read them through the 12 and 12 and move on. Today, six and seven has been a whirlwind of a journey in like four sentences. Don't know how that even is possible besides the magic of God. You know, I do my fifth step and step six asks me, am I ready to have everything that I found objectionable taken away? Which is crazy because I always miss the word objectionable. Because in my head, I thought it was just like, I did my fifth step. God, take away all the bad stuff and make me perfect. Instead, it's everything that I found objectionable. I wasn't ready to stop the drinking until the drinking was objectionable, until I was in enough pain and discomfort. For some reason, I thought six and seven was all about my comfort. Thought that when I did the seven-step prayer, that I was saying, God, I'm uncomfortable with this stuff. I lie, I steal, I cheat. I'm full of fear. Take it away. Make me feel good in my skin. the seventh step prayer today, what it means for me is, God, take away anything that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. The good and the bad. Whatever you deem fit, when you deem it fit, to be removed. There's a lot of stuff that I would have thought would have been taken away. Sometimes people tell me things and I look like, I can't believe I said that, but it was useful. I had one young lady recently tell me, like, I chose to go to a meeting instead of on a date with a boy, Ebony. And I was looking at her like, okay, I don't care. And she said, do you remember that you told me when I would pick a meeting over a boy, maybe I actually meant I wanted to get sober? And I was like, my mouth, why would I say that? Like, why would I say that? But that does also sound like me. And I just think like that is not me excusing the directness of the, yeah, I could be gentler. But I just think about stuff like that. The things that God has used me for in ways that I did not know and made me useful. I move on to step eight and nine and I start making this list. And step eight has become one of my favorite steps, which is weird because it's like this middle, like what? But step eight is where I got to really see the patterns of my behavior and how they're affecting people as I'm making this list. And I'm looking at the imaginary fourth column and I'm saying, this is where I am to blame. Not this is my part, because my part starts as 50-50 and then it turns into my part is 40 me, 60 you. And then by the end of the my part story, it's really only 5% my fault and 95% your part. But instead, the fourth column shows me where I am to blame, what I have done, where I am wrong. And I'm making this list on my eighth step and looking at this, and I'm getting ready to go out and make things right and stand in front of people and say I'm wrong. And there's something magical in seeing these patterns, how I'm doing the same things again and again. This is what they meant when they told me alcohol was but a symptom. I see all the ways I've always been just like eaten from the inside out by the spiritual malady and why. And why I needed the effect produced by alcohol. So I start making this list and I get ready to go out and I start making amends. And I made amends to my sister the first time in 2016. Then COVID happens and we're on quarantine. My sister lives in DC. She's down in my house staying with me for a while. And the first time I made amends to my sister, she was like, "The only thing I want you to do is to stay sober and keep doing what you're doing." And I loved those because I meant I didn't have to do anything but AA. Like, sweet. 5 years later, my sister sits down and she says, "Hey, Eb, do you remember when you made amends to me?" I said, "Yes." "I'm ready to talk about it now."
Oh.
Turns out that I don't get to choose when or where people truly accept those amends. And she was ready to sit down and actually tell me the things that I forgot to put on that list and tell me how those things affected her. And then she told me she was afraid to say those things to me in earlier sobriety because she was scared that I would drink again. She did not have faith in my sobriety at that time. It took about 5.5 years for my sister to see that I was truly changing and different and that she could have that honest conversation with me. And tell me the ways I hurt her, the way I was that tornado in her life. And she just told me some things, and I just had to sit there and listen. And I had to just, inside, I'm like, "You waited 5 years to say this. You should have just said it." That's not my job. My job is to show up, suit up, and do what God tells me to do. And that moment is show up as a sister. I get to step 10, and I love the 10th step. I called it the chapstick step because I'm the girl who has like chapstick in my pocket, chapstick in my purse, car chapstick, gym chapstick, desk chapstick, bedroom chapstick. And whenever my lips are dry, I use my chapstick. It's the whenever chapstick. Like, it's not at night. Step 10 tells me whenever these things crop up, I don't have to wait until I'm going to bed to do a 10th step. In fact, I usually need to do a 10th step when I start interacting with the world around me later on in the day. But what it allows me to do is to use the things that I learned in the prior steps to do a quick inventory. Where have I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or afraid? And I'm looking at this stuff, and I get to invite God in the moment. Pray first. And if I need to talk to someone, I can. But then I love also making things right, but resolutely turning myself to being helpful to someone else. How can I help someone else? Turning my thoughts and directing them once again away from Ebony, because the mirror in my head is always towards Ebony. But instead, you guys have turned me, told me, and shown me to take that mirror and point it out towards y'all. To deflect my thinking of just breaking myself down and everything that's wrong in the world and all of this magnet or all of this like madness in my head. And instead, why don't I just see how someone else is doing? How are you today? Someone asked me, we had a conversation last night about my students, and someone this morning followed up about it. And I forget how magical stuff like that is, because it just made my morning to know like people really do listen here. People really do care, something that small. And I can do the exact same thing for others today. And I get to step 11. And it starts at nighttime. And I was always that girl, why does it start at night instead of in the morning? Like, why is it there? Like, why didn't he make a mistake? And my sponsor was like, isn't it better to know that you've taken care of everything and it's nice and neat? So once you wake up, you're a clean slate. And I'm like, oh, For a long time, I thought the prayer and meditation part, the meditation, then I had to be crisscross applesauce, humming and chanting. And I'm so grateful that I am surrounded by people who tell me to use a dictionary and look up meditation. And I love the thought of being intentional thinking. I can do some intentional thinking. I can set aside Ebony. And one of my favorite prayers is the set aside prayer. I can set aside everything I think I know about everything and just invite God in. I can clean up the mess of the day, any of the residual stuff that just fell through the cracks of step 10, so that I can put my head down and be at perfect peace and ease. I was not the girl who would put my head down and go to sleep. I was the girl who would put my head down and I'm going through the conversation I had with you and how I should have said this. And tomorrow when I see you, this is what's going to happen. And I can't believe that happened. And I'm just full of angst and I can't rest. And today I can go to bed and just sleep. And I wake up in the morning and I invite God in. I got to walk around this morning, like, what an amazing sight, and feel connected with God and just breathe, listen to the birds, take pictures, just like connect. That is not how I used to start my days. I start my days with a list of things to do, color-coded and prioritized, and I tell God what's going to happen. And today I wake up in my own house, quiet, and I can breathe and just ask God, like, this is kind of what I'm thinking, but what do you got for me today? And my favorite part of step 11 is the end and the power to carry that out. Because what I've learned, if anything, in Alcoholics Anonymous is being of service is not convenient. Being of service is not easy. Showing up to meetings and places with strangers, answering the phone, taking group inventories, doing, that's what I do for the BAC, doing all of that stuff is just out of the way. Sometimes I just want to sleep in, be in my pajamas all day, or look at my phone ring and not answer it. And the power to carry that out is doing the things I don't want to do because I need to do them anyway. In this simple way, we let God discipline us. This is where the discipline comes. This is where I get the connection to do that stuff. And then step 12, I've had the spiritual awakening as the result of the other 11 steps. And I get to practice these principles in all my affairs. It's so cool to work in the middle school and watch my students make amends to each other because I make amends to them. And so I would say, oh, I was wrong for that. I really thought you were talking, and that was just me taking it out on you. You weren't. I was wrong. And then to watch them do that, like, who does that without being an alcoholic and not having a program of recovery? You just know that you're wrong. Like, that's crazy to me. And I get to practice these principles in all my affairs. Today, my life looks pretty much the same. I live with, well, I actually bought a house. I don't live with my parents anymore. New part of the story. But my life used to look exactly the same. I was living with mom and dad. My mother has Alzheimer's. I'm teaching. Everything on the outside pretty much is the same as when I came in, but my perspective is completely different. Today, I am not a bystander in the life of Ebony. I am fully participating. I get to show up and I have the joy of living. I am alive today. Alcoholics Anonymous has made me uniquely useful and usefully whole in ways that I had no idea I needed. I would have sold myself short if all I wanted, all I thought I was going to get from AA was to stop drinking. Instead, what I've gotten is a life beyond my wildest dreams. I've been able to be a daughter, a sister, a mother, a friend. I get to have this connection to something that just keeps getting bigger and better every day, and I'm always shocked at the God of it all. It is, if you were new or old or in between, all I know is that taking the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, even with not even 100% of my like energy, gets returned tenfold. I have a life beyond the dreams that I ever thought I deserved, and it's a direct result of the God of my understanding, effective sponsorship, and these simple actions. So thank you all for having me. What a joy and a privilege it is to be here. Thank you.